Also, don't let me forget, before we go, those sheets I promised you guys last night with the modern equivalents of the biblical prophetical nations, I brought those. I should have set them out there. I forgot. So remind me before we're done, and we'll pass those out, get those out to everybody. So the book of Exodus. Now, remember, the overall writing theme of the book of Exodus is that of redemption, okay? And what Exodus is about is God taking that which the world surrounds God's people with, it sort of pressures them and brings all of the, you know, sort of the rotten things to bear. But in spite of that, God will redeem his people. He will release his people from the bondage that we find him in. Now, we've talked many times about the book of Exodus being a perfect picture of the sinner coming to Christ and being in bondage and being under this tyrant leadership of the enemy who would seek to not give us any rest and deceive and destroy and all of these other things. But like the people of God in the Old Testament, God has brought them out of that. And that's really, to me, what the book of Exodus is all about. And in the midst of all of that, we talked about it, and this is actually where we're going to be headed, so I don't want to take a lot of time tonight. But when we begin to study now, as they journey through the wilderness, that all of the stuff that God provides for them and what we call the wilderness wanderings, are all, again, as all Old Testament does, points to Christ. I'm going to show you a chart here that I put together this afternoon to sort of explain this. But everything always points to Christ. So whether it's the manna from heaven or whether it's the bread from heaven or whether it's the bitter waters, the marah turned into the sweet waters as the people, the water from the rock, we keep seeing it over and over again. But everything in the Old Testament, and since we're in Exodus, points to him. And as we get to Sinai, the law, of course, is going to be given. God's going to guide his people by day and in a specific way during the night. And also, he's going to give them sort of his regulations, I guess, and what that means now as God has called the people aside. He's delivered them. He's brought them. Now, this is what it means to be the people of God. And the things of remembrance, like the festival system, all of the things that they were to celebrate, starting with Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles and so on and so forth, the day Yom Kippur, or the Day of Atonement. And then, of course, those would actually be the holy days. And then the festivals, the sacrificial system, then with the guilt offering, the burnt offering, the sin offering, the fellowship offering, the grain offering, the wave offerings, blah, 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 blah. And every one of those are symbolic of Christ. And so that's one of the reasons Exodus, to me, is really significant. Now, Exodus is really sort of brought to the surface. We've talked about this, and we've relied a little bit, not extensively yet, but we will. We've shown that there's a lot of Exodus that is explained for us in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament. And, of course, that's by no mistake, because the book of Hebrews is written to?
The Jews.
You imagine that. So everything that has to do with them, this is what the book of Hebrews is doing. And basically, the message of Hebrews is to leave all of those elementary teachings. Enough of the salvation, enough of the deliverance and the redemption. You understand that stuff. Move on. You know? You can't remain in that position. And, of course, the great verse chapter that throws everybody off, chapter 6, that says, well, you can't, the person that's seen these things and has tasted God and has experienced this and experienced that, if they turn away from it, to ever be lightened again. And, of course, because it's in the New Testament, we think that's New Testament theology. What theology is it speaking of? Old Testament. And yet we try to equate a New Testament, you know, conclusion to it. You can't do that. It's not talking about the salvation from Christ. It's talking about how all of these things pointed to Christ, and you need to get rid of those, because those things, if you continue to hold on to those things and walk away from those things, then there's no hope for you. You got to let those things go. Everything that he talks about, there is an Old Testament principle. Not a new, well, it is a new, but the new establishes the old, right? So there's some really interesting things that are going on there. So we've seen that a bit of a connection there. Paul has referred us back to much of what God has done. We're going to see more of that when we get into 9, 10, and 11 of the book of Romans. That is, if I can ever conclude chapter 8. But anyways, so that's what's going on. So what I did is I've had this chart. If you guys have taken the when we had the classes, which I intend to do again, it's just I'm trying to figure out how to do all of this, fit all of this in. But we did the Bible introduction, and we kind of looked at the sort of an overview of the Bible and seeing how everything fits together. So some of you will remember this chart, but this is what it is. It's just basically an hourglass thing, and because we're focused on the Old Testament, that's why the lines are are a bit different, but you'll see where I'm going with this. In the Old Testament, this is, takes a world view, okay? And what it does is it brings the world to Messiah, in other words, to the cross. That's what the Old Testament did. God's call of Abraham, God's establishment of the people of Israel, God's rules, regulations for the people of Israel, their observances, their traditions, their ceremonies, all pointed to Christ. Okay, who was to come in the future. So that's the Old Testament worldview. Now, there's many ways that you can break this down, and I have actually broken it down a little different than this, than we did in the class, but you'll get the idea. In Genesis, chapters 1 to 11, we see that the focus is on mankind as a whole. You see creation in chapters 1 and 2. You see the fall in chapter 3. You see Cain and Abel in chapter 4. You see the nations of chapter 5. Okay, and then you see chapter 6 with the attempt to tamper with the genetic or created order of God, which of course brings along with this Nephilim, whatever they are, and we don't have time to get into that because that's a lot of fun. But anyway, and then of course that leads ultimately to chapter 7 and chapter 8, which of course are the flood, and then you have 9, and then you have 10, which is the table of nations where we looked at in our study on Islam, which the sons of Shem, the sons of Ham, the sons of Japheth, which became Shem became, remember, what we would know today as the Semitic peoples, the Jews. In other words, Ham became what we would recognize today primarily as the Arabs and Africans, as some of them anyway. And then Japheth became what we know today as the Japhethites. Remember, Japheth settled in the Caucasus Mountains and from there spread out, which is why if you're European of European descent, which most of us are, we're called Caucasian because that's where we came from. We're Japhethites. There's so much to get into this, and I was just watching a program today when I came in to eat some lunch and stuff, and it just drives me batty with these people, and I'm just going to have to research this because I was watching the History Channel, and they were talking about, you know, the doom of the world and all the stuff that they always talk about, and they were talking about the old ice age, and there was an ice age in, you know, 75,000 years ago or whatever. Anyway, it almost wiped out the whole planet, and of course, everybody that survived, you know, of course, lived in Africa, and so literally they can mitochondrial DNA and go back and check the women and stuff, and it all points to going back to Africa. Now, that isn't true. It's not true. And yet, there they are. So, anyway, that kind of stuff that just drives me up a wall. Because what it goes back to is Genesis chapter 10. Hello. But anyway, so Genesis 1 to 11 is all about mankind. When you get to chapter 12, then, of course, this is the introduction of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and stuff. This is where the covenant plays this massive part because it's through Abraham that God gives the covenant. But notice you're still in Genesis, okay? Then when you pass Genesis where we are now and you move into Exodus and Judges, God has called his people out, but they're not yet a nation. We call them a nation, but technically they're not. They're tribal nomads who were once slaves in Egypt and are now been set free, and they will ultimately become a nation, but that's not going to happen until we get to the book of 1 Samuel all the way through the end of the Old Testament, and we move from the patriarchal, in other words, Abraham, Isaac, to the monarchical with the kings, okay? David being the individual, being that focus. So you can see how God in the Old Testament whittles it all right down to David, and then ultimately, then to the New Testament overview, which is just the opposite. In the Old Testament, the world is brought to Messiah. In the New Testament, the Messiah is taken to the world. Okay? That's the difference. That's the big, that's why you see it narrows down to the cross, and then the cross goes to the rest of the world. And of course, we see this is the heart of the New Testament, the gospel, the gospels, of course, which identify the Messiah that everybody was waiting for there. Actually, I should have put that in the middle of those, our little hourglass-shaped thing there. And then, of course, this is the book of Acts. You shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth, Jesus said. So the Old Testament brings them here. This is why the temple was so significant to the Jews and the tabernacle and all of these rules and regulations, because they, the Jews, were to represent God to the world. And ultimately the temple, and it was supposed to have freedom for the nations to come in, and there was a court set aside for the Jews, there's a court set aside for the women, and there was a court set aside for the Goyim, the Gentiles. And it's that court that everybody was hanging on, and they turned into a mall when Jesus entered the temple, and they had turned the place where the Gentiles were supposed to come and be able to worship the God of Israel, they had turned it into a den of thieves. And that's why Jesus was so angry. And that's why he replied with, "Have you not read that my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations but you?" See? They had turned the very court where the world was supposed to come and embrace the God of Israel. The very place where those people had come, they had commerce had pushed them outside, and that was why Jesus was furious. And that's why he condemned the temple. He did not cleanse the temple. He condemned it at that point. Okay? So that's what we have. Now, a couple other things in a bit of our recap. We're looking at this. We didn't look at this because we jumped into Exodus, but we have looked at Genesis in the past. This is that patriarchal aspect of that, and of course, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Now, all three of those guys received the promise of God, the covenant of God. Okay? All of them. I didn't put down the verses. I probably should have, but clearly the one we all remember is Genesis 12. In particular, verses 2 and 3, but 1 to 3, there were God's call on Abraham, because remember, this will now, even though God's setting apart ultimately what's going to become a nation, the blessing from that nation is going to be to all nations, which is again why Jesus was upset at the temple. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, okay? And the story of Joseph was what led us into our study in the book of Exodus. Because what God does 430 years prior to the time that we're studying now in our study in Exodus is that God, through some pretty pathetic, from our perspective, and pretty, controversial maybe, circumstances, sends poor Joseph into Egypt. His brothers betray him. He's falsely accused. Gee, sound familiar? He's all of these things, but everywhere he goes, God seems to bless him because he's making the most out of every opportunity. You see? And it was his open mouth inserts foot syndrome when he was younger, saying that everybody's going to serve me, that got him into trouble. But nevertheless, God used that to get Joseph into Egypt. The reason God got Joseph into Egypt is because he was going to send Jacob into Egypt. And he needed someone there to provide for him. So God sends Joseph ahead. Now, it's not until later in Joseph's life, 23 years actually, after he first arrives at the age of 17 in Israel, that he finally meets his brothers and comes to terms with, hey, you meant this for bad, but God meant it for good. And I have come here to do this. And so now Egypt is the place that God draws his people into, where God will now use the next 400 years, which is precisely what he told Abraham. Your descendants will serve another nation for 400 years. You say, well, I thought it was 430. Well, you know, the point is that God's using 400 times of general, but when it comes to, you know, the actual days and stuff like that, you know, 30 years isn't that long when you're looking at a period of 400. So anyway, so God tells them that this is what's going to happen, and it's through Joseph that this is all going to take place. All right? Now, interestingly enough, just prior to Joseph being sent into Egypt, Egypt is overcome, and Egypt prior to this period, during the earlier dynasties and so on and so forth, had been ruled. They had a pharaoh, but basically it was a landholder. I mean, you had property and so on and so forth. But when the Hyksos came in, now the Hyksos were Semitic peoples. In other words, they were relatives of Joseph and Jacob. Imagine that. But when they came in and they conquered Egypt, and we talked about all of this at the time, and, you know, short of going for another 3 weeks and explaining all this, when the Hyksos came in, they overcame these guys, and the Hyksos ruled Egypt for that period of time. You can see there for right around 200 years. These are approximate dates, but roughly 1750 to 1550. So God sends the Hyksos in to control the nation of Egypt. Imagine that, a Semite. And so when Joseph gets in there and gets raised up, and, you know, this is one of the reasons probably he was favored. But interestingly enough, we know that later on, I can't remember which pharaoh it was, I thought I would remember. But anyway, one of the pharaohs at the end of this period comes in and defeats the Hyksos, chases them out. But because Joseph has been there, and what does Joseph do? He causes Egypt to, remember under the famine, to sell their grain, and then when they couldn't sell the grain, they sold their cattle and their land, ultimately. And so what God does is use Joseph to put all of Egypt under control of the pharaoh. So now Egypt is no longer a bunch of landholders. It's ruled by a pharaoh who now has elevated himself to God because he rules everything. Okay? And of course, this is about 400 years later that this all takes place. Okay, and so Joseph then dies. So 70 people, we're told in the last chapter of Genesis, actually it might be the 49th chapter, but anyway, that 70 people with Jacob entered in there when Joseph provides for them, and then starting in the, there's a 400-year gap between Genesis chapter 50 and Exodus chapter 1. Interestingly enough, we don't know a lot about what happened in there, just like we don't know about the 400 years from Malachi to Christ. It's interesting how God tends to do things like that. But what we do know is 400 years prior to that, 70 go in. 400 years later, there's probably estimates of a couple of million people now during this period of time. And, of course, now there's a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. Well, why didn't he know Joseph? Because the Egyptians were back in control and an Egyptian. And oftentimes people that are really into this kind of stuff historically, chronologically about this stuff, will say, well, why don't we have any accounts from Egyptian records of the period of time when the Israelites were there? Well, the question then is, well, why don't they have records of the Hyksos period? Who wants to keep a historical record of your failure? Nobody wants to do that. You study all the nations of the world, and of course they always report their victories. How often do you read of their defeats? When you study history, as a matter of fact, in this context, especially biblical history, what you find is when you look at all of the extra-biblical writings, as it were, what you're looking at is all of these historical things, and they all have, you know, they have steels, you know, these big stone pillars that somebody was up there chiseling these things out, and stuff like that. Some of you remember that because books were written that way when you're just kidding. Stuff recorded like that, and there's different books and all of that, and they definitely recorded their victories, but whenever there was a defeat, you always read something like, well, and we withdrew back to our country so that we could rebuild the army. No, you got whooped. You got whooped, and this is why you're back in, but they never record that. It's interesting when you study the scripture. Only the scripture portrays the people of Israel as winning, losing, failing miserably, and suffering the consequences of that because they realized who their God was. It's interesting when you study the world history. Of course, it goes on through this period. Now, 400 years later, it's that Amenhotep there, the second, who's the Pharaoh of the Exodus, or at least it would appear. Some would say that it was Pharaoh Ramses who came after him. I tend to believe it's Ramses, and the reason is because there's a record that as they were exiting the city later on, where they saw the temples that were dedicated to Ramses. Well, if Ramses hadn't ruled yet, why would there be a temple dedicated to him? But, you know, this is the way chronologists do things and historians, so who knows? What does it really matter? No. The people of Israel were in bondage in there, and we know that God brought them out miraculously and put them exactly where he wanted to be in the Promised Land. Dates are nice if we got them, but if we don't, oh well. We don't have a date for the Lord's return, do we? Nope. Does it change the importance? Nope. It don't matter. See? So it would be nice to have, but we don't have it. So that's the patriarchal period. That's basically Genesis, which gets us up to this point. And, of course, then we begin the monarchical period, which we talked about before. And Moses, of course, is the first prophet. Notice that prior to the kings, God uses the prophets to speak. Now, remember what a prophet was. We got to change our thinking from what the world wants us to think. A prophet is not a foreteller of the future. That is not the gift of prophecy. The gift of prophecy is the proclamation of the truth. Thus saith the Lord. That's what a prophet was. That is the prophecy. If it talked about the future, then it was predictive. If it didn't, then it was didactive, what they call didactive. It was about something that was currently happening. But we've twisted this and changed this to where prophets now are all these people that walked around all the time seeing the future. Because we're bombarded with stuff from Nostradamus and Edgar Cayce, and the list goes on and on. Holy smoly. Is that the wind? Yeah. Now listen, if it gets dark in here, someone's going to have to hold me because I get frightened.
Sorry.
Yeah. Anyway. So Moses is that first one because he's proclaiming God's word. Go to Pharaoh and say. What is that? That's proclaiming the word of God. Moses was the first prophet. And later on, I think it's actually Deuteronomy 18, it might be. But anyway, somewhere, Moses says, and God himself will raise up unto you a prophet like me. And he's ultimately talking about the line of prophets, but ultimately, of course, Jesus Christ, who fills the role, the rule of prophet, priest, and king. What's that called? Triune, there you go, that'll work. So prophet Moses, all right? Now what we saw when God raises these guys up Because remember, God doesn't talk, we read what David talked to God, but really what God was talking to David through Samuel. Okay? So, but interesting, anyway, so prophet is, Moses is the prophet. So this is why God sends him to proclaim God's word, and the conflict there, what we call the 10 plagues, or actually 10 judgments, is what we said before, okay, 10 expressions of God's judgment. And ultimately what this is about is the God of Israel versus the gods of Egypt. Notice God's plural. Because Egypt, not to this day, because they're Islamic now, were very polytheistic. In other words, many gods, poly, many, theos, God, many gods, okay? So that's ultimately what that conflict where we just studied just before diving into Islam. Now, we did take a look at Passover, and in particular, we took some time to spend, and I think we all know that Passover clearly, if nothing else does, though there's certainly a lot, but if nothing else does, Passover surely is talking about Jesus. I mean, you can't get beyond it. That is, if you see with the eyes of faith. Okay, so we understand that. So clearly the Passover was pointing forward. And then the Exodus, what we're actually going to jump into next week, is really the second event. We have not gotten there yet. The people are prepared, and the people are now being called an army. If you remember, we concluded that in the armies of Israel prepared. Well, all of a sudden now they're an army. Well, they're not technically an army, but the writer, probably Moses, is, you know, trying to lift up these guys up. Believe now there's couple different dates. You can see here 1280 to 1260 probably. I can give you a whole rundown on the dates and why the early date versus a late date. This is what's called the early date. The late date puts this at about in roughly the 14th century BC, where this is 13th century BC. So there's about 170 year difference between the late date and so on and so forth. When did they leave Egypt and stuff? And, you know, somewhere. But anyway, this is basically the one that we've been bouncing off of. I could give you all the reasons for that, but it's not really necessary. Now here's the key thing to remember, that these two events are the central point of Judaism to this day. To this day, nothing has changed. From a theological perspective, they are the Old Testament equivalent of the New Testament Calvary. To the Jew, that's how significant these are. Okay? Judaism would fail, would not be able to stand without the Passover and the Exodus. It would simply crumble if the Exodus wasn't the one thing. And of course, the nations, even though Egypt might have kind of toned it down a little bit, what happened, the other nations clearly recognized it because they were afraid of the God of Israel, okay, as they went through this. So this is huge. So what is significant to them as the cross is, which of course is Calvary, is to us. If you take the cross away, then what point is there in Christianity? I mean, Jesus lived and died, was a great guy, wonderful teacher, great philosopher, and all of this wonderful stuff, good. But what has that done? Nothing. So you see the significance. We have to understand that from a biblical, Jewish, Jerusalem-centric perspective, the Exodus and the Passover are extremely important. Abraham, which brought them to them, of course, is, but obviously Moses, Abraham and Moses were two of their key figures. There were many others, but primarily those. So that's the theological. Now, from a historical perspective, this is significant because this group of alien slaves, now by aliens, we don't mean from another world, because now we've got, what's his name, Hawkins out there, Dawkins or whatever it is, the cerebral palsy guy now who's going to, you know, that's Stephen, there you go. That's going to, tell everybody that there's aliens. It's sad. I mean, that's really sad. But anyway, so alien slaves means obviously somebody in a foreign land. So the alien slaves, from a historical perspective, become a united people, and they're obviously ultimately a nation. Okay, that does not happen though until the people say, "We're not interested in the prophets any longer. We want a king. That's what we want." So God then gives them what they want, tells them what's going to happen, but gives them what they want. So that kind of brings us up to speed. Now, there was a lot that we could have covered here. I mean, we're right now, this, by the way, this is a slide 100, and we're through 12 chapters. So I thought, well, gee, I'll just go click through the slides and talk about it. It's like, okay, that's not going to work. So I got to bring it about. Now, I gave you guys copies way on as Exodus in a nutshell. It's the one with all the lines. You know, take a look at that again, sort of refresh your memory. If you don't have that, let me know next week. Check at home, see if you got it. And if you don't, then we'll get that back out there to you because it's pretty important, pretty significant on actually the flow. But then, of course, and here were the verses that we concluded with as we jumped off into our study. Now the sojourn, this is Exodus chapter 12. Now the sojourn, in other words, the journey of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. Okay? And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. So it's interesting how Moses, all of a sudden, from the slaves, which were very powerful, no question about it, but all of a sudden they were an army. They're not even a nation yet. They haven't received the law of God yet. They haven't received any of these things. This is just exiting Egypt. There's representatives from each of the 12 tribes, but no organization. The Levites now are, at this point, are no more significant than the Judahites are, or the Simeonites, or the Reubenites, or the, you know, whatever, the Asherites, right? They're because nothing has been designated at this point. They're just the people of God who've been in slavery, and now they're coming out. It's when they get to Sinai, and they receive the law that God gives them and establishes with this group of people now, and then God starts saying that these are the things that are going to happen, where Levi, they belong to me, God says, become the priestly line, of which, of course, Moses was from, and then Judahites and the, you know, Simeonites and all these guys and stuff like that, that's when they're going to actually start forming or become united. That's at the point when they're under standards or banners, flags, whatever you want to call it, that they actually become a sort of a force to be reckoned with. And they're recognized as the people of Israel. We have some of the historical writings that identify them as the people of Israel, the Hittites for one. But ultimately, they're not called the nation of Israel because they don't have a king or anything at that point. Okay? Which is another reason, by the way, that they wanted to have a king. So the armies, it's interesting how this changes. Now they're ready to march out of Israel. And it's funny that this army is quaking in the knees when they're backed up against the Red Sea, which is going to be our next, well, as we move from the Exodus and we get to the Red Sea, it's kind of, it seems like a short journey. Right? And for the armies of Israel, they're flipping out at the sea. Oh no, we're toast. It's interesting that phrase is used, but anyways. Verse 42, it is a night. This night, this Passover night, which is going to ultimately lead, it's Passover that sets the people free. It's the blood of the Lamb, and the Lamb's covering for the wrath of God that sets the free, that allows the exit from bondage, the Exodus. Okay? That's what's happening here. So that particular night is a solemn night, of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. Remember the significance we said that these two play. This is that night of the Lord. I love that. It's the night of the Lord. It has nothing to do with the people. Because when you look at the Old Testament, it's interesting, like I said before, we always talk about the faith of Abraham, but it is not about the faith of Abraham. It's about the God of Abraham's faith. It is not about the history or the history of Israel in its relation to God. No, it's the faithfulness of God to his nation, Israel, or to his people at this point in time. See, and this, by the way, is what ends up ultimately happening to the nation, which leads to Jesus' condemnation of the temple. They had forgotten about that the redemption of God for the people of Israel was important, and what they focused on was the reception of blessings. And then in their eyes now, it isn't about the redemption of God. It's about receiving the blessings of God. Well, that's nice, but that never was the focus. I'm sending you to a land, and you're going to overtake homes, and you're going to get fields that you didn't plant, and homes that you didn't build. They couldn't take credit for that. So the recipients of blessing, oh my gosh, that's what we are, and we're just special in God's eyes. So it's Jeremiah's issue in Jeremiah's day. See? It wasn't about the recipient of blessing. It was about the redemption of God. But they had lost sight of that. And that's why, well, it's no big deal if the Gentiles can't get in here because, well, they're not special anyway. Right? You've heard the story. Remember, the Goyim means Gentile. Where the two guys are talking and the guy says, how odd that God would choose the Jew. And the Jew looks at the guy and says, no, not so odd, because the Goyim annoy him. I thought that's great. Anyway, so do you see? So hopefully, I mean, we've sort of pointed in the direction here, and you can understand where we've been, and where we're going to go from this point. I'm going to really focus on. So it's not going to be. It's going to be exposition, but it's not going to be verse by verse like we typically do because there's a ton. So we're going to look at sort of in sections from the wilderness wandering, so to speak. And that, of course, it might take us a couple of weeks. I'm not saying it's going to be once per week. And then, of course, at Sinai, receiving the law, which is of course Sinai, which is actually before the wandering in the wilderness. And then, we're going to move through that way. Okay. There's just too much to do otherwise. And so once again, as we get into this, I'll have some specific little charts here and there that I'll make available to you. But it's not going to be like our typical Wednesday night where I provide stuff. There's just too much. It's just impossible for me to keep up with unless we had an entire staff of people putting this stuff together. It's just insane. All right.